Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, November 4th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Villa Veritas Foundation, Gerhonks in New York, an inpatient rehabilitation and wellness center providing healing, focusing on the body, mind, and spirit for those with various forms of addiction. VillaVeritas.org for inquiries. Joining us for Medical Monday today is Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center. He is here to discuss Alzheimer's disease and associated treatments. Medical Monday, usually a popular program. If you want to get your call in, I recommend you do it right now. 800-348-2551. We'll put you on hold. And we go first come, first serve. 800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. David Hart, your call's coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center joins us today to discuss Alzheimer's disease. A graduate of New Jersey Medical Center, Dr. Hart has been part of the Alzheimer's Center at Albany Med since 2015, and with 20 years of private practice prior to that, he has overseen numerous clinical trials on Alzheimer's treatment. He is also an associate professor of neurology at Albany Medical Center. If you want to be a part of today's conversation, give us a call, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also tweet your questions at WAMC Vox Pop or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ray. Glad to be here.
There was some news about a possible Alzheimer's drug in the last week or so, and maybe you could fill us in on what's going on with that.
Sure. Well, it's an interesting story. For the last 20 years or so, there's been a drive to attack the accumulation of beta amyloid in the brain. This is a protein. It's a naturally occurring, normally occurring protein in the brain, and it builds up in the brain in Alzheimer's disease. It's one of the first changes that happens in the process of Alzheimer's disease.
Do we know why that happens?
There's still argument over exactly why. Some people think it is the cause of the disease process. A few people think that it is actually protective. Still some argument about that, but we know for sure that it is an early part of the disease process. So for a couple of decades now, there have been a long list of medicines which have been used to try to block the formation of beta amyloid or cut down on its congealing into these amyloid plaques, which are one of the changes in the brain that Dr. Alzheimer first described about 110 years ago. Mm-hmm. And all of these trials have failed. The trial that we're talking about right here was the Biogen aducanumab trial. And this was a treatment with what's called a monoclonal antibody. It's an engineered protein that was specifically built to recognize and attach to amyloid to help clear it out of the brain.
Okay. But not the rest of the – it's only in the brain?
Amyloid can be considered a class of proteins, but there's one specific type of amyloid which happens in the brain and which is associated with the disease process of Alzheimer's. So just trying to get it out from the brain.
Mm-hmm.
So this study had, as many of them do, had what's called a planned futility analysis. Partway through the study, when a certain number of subjects had finished the study, they stopped and they crunched the numbers. Reason for this is that if a study is not going to be able to show effectiveness, that you want to stop it before you dose people unnecessarily, put them at any kind of risk from a medication that you are able to tell is not going to work. And also because it's enormously expensive to do a clinical trial.
Now, when you say they crunched the numbers, what numbers are we crunching here?
So this is a study which began enrolling a number of years ago. I think the first patient enrolled may have been in 2015. And so they had a planned analysis after a certain number of patients had gone through the study. It was a year and a half long trial, but somebody who started in 2015 would finish it late in 2016 or early in 17. Mm-hmm. Somebody who started in the trial in 2017 would have another year and a half to go beyond that. So everybody didn't start at the same time. They took the patients who had completed the trial as of the end of December of last year. By the time they got all the numbers together to be able to look at it, this was the middle of March. They crunched the numbers and they came up with a number that said, no, this study is doomed to failure. And so they stopped it.
The numbers are the successful outcomes or are they measuring looking, these
Well, the number of things. Their primary endpoint was looking at progression on a rating scale that we use in assessing patients with Alzheimer's, something called the clinical dementia rating. It's a functional rating scale. It's got six domains. It looks at how people are doing in terms of memory, doing their usual daily activities, how they're functioning when they go out in public. And so this, as opposed to looking at a memory number or something like that, which might only be important when you're getting a memory test, this is thought to be a more holistic assessment of how somebody's doing, you know, in their usual daily life.
Well, what caught my eye with this news item, and of course, in the newsroom, there is nary a doctor to be seen, so we only have what we read as a baseline. But they re-crunched the numbers, and exactly how did they do that? Why did they do that? And is it ethical to do that?
Certainly, it's ethical to do it because, they used data through the end of December. When the numbers came out, they stopped the trial. This was March 22nd. So nobody else was dosed after March 22nd. But you had all these patients who had been dosed between the end of December and the middle of March. So it's additional information, and it's standard practice to try to assess all of the information that you've got. The really interesting thing was that when they looked, I think there were an additional 300 patients that had completed the trial over that three-month period. They found that actually the study did meet its primary endpoint. It showed almost a 25% reduction in progression on this rating scale, the clinical dementia rating. This is really striking. There has not yet been a phase three trial, meaning a late stage, we're almost ready to get this released trial, to show that kind of success. So this is enormously exciting. It is a little bit curious in that there were two identical trials being done at the same time because the FDA wants two trials that show the same sort of information in order to give approval. Mm-hmm. One of the trials showed this pretty striking improvement, and the other trial did not. Now, there are some statistical preliminary explanations which may explain that. They say they're going to give us more data at a meeting in early December, the Clinical Trials in Alzheimer's Disease meeting. Mm-hmm. But at this point, it's the closest thing that we have ever had to having a medication that may slow progression of this terrible disorder.
Dr. David Hart is our guest. We talk about Alzheimer's today. He is from Albany Medical Center. Well, you say it may, and you're hopeful, stop the progression. How about reversing the effects? Is there any progress in this?
Well, I think there's been a lot of progress over the last few years. I think that we're starting to move into what we can really consider the age of molecular biology. And what that means is that rather than treating a symptom, rather than, for example, a medicine like donepezil or Aricept, which changes the level of one of the chemicals in the brain to make memory functions work easier, we're getting to the stage where we're trying to interfere with the disease process itself. And as I say, if this medicine is authorized by the FDA, if it's approved, then that will be the first one. But there are other processes going on in Alzheimer's disease. The science there is very promising, I think. And whether this medicine does or does not make it to the big time, I think there are a lot of things coming along which will get us there. And I think that, hopefully before I'm done practicing, we will have some meaningful treatments.
You talk about before you end practicing. You've been at this game now for a couple of decades at least, yeah. Right? What progress have we seen? I mean, are you still hopeful?
I'm very hopeful. When I go to the Alzheimer's presentations at the neurology meetings, when I go to the Alzheimer's Association International Conference, when I look at what's going on in the journals, I think that the science is really coming along. I think that when I mentioned that this medicine we were just talking about targets amyloid, which is the first identifiable process. But there's another protein that builds up in the brain called tau protein. And this is much later in the process. It is much closer in time to when people develop symptoms. And so that may be a much better target for affecting how people are actually functioning. That may be our best hope for really stopping the disease in its tracks.
Dr. David Hart is our guest. Our number is 800-348-2551. Alzheimer's Today on Medical Monday, 1-800-348-2551. We'll take a break. We'll be back. Thank you. Vox Pop Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center joins us today, and we are discussing Alzheimer's disease. Before we get to the calls, Doctor, you had mentioned in the trial for this drug, and I forget the name of it, from Biogen, doesn't matter, that you do a test. And I assume this is something of a baseline for patients. You must test memory and et cetera, cognitive function,
exactly,
and then see how it progresses over time?
Right. There are a number of things that are looked at. We look at, I mentioned, not getting too bogged down in memory scores, but certainly there's a lot of memory testing that is done. There's testing of different kinds of memory to see, you don't think about it, but you have memory for sounds, you have memory for sights, you have memory for ideas, you have a lot of different kinds of memory. So we try to assess that.
That must be tricky.
It is, but there are well-validated tools for looking at that sort of thing and being able to follow it over the course of a trial. So typically, I mentioned that this trial was a year and a half of the double-blind phase. During that year and a half, at baseline and then every 3 months after that, people had repeat testing done to see how people progressed over the course of the study. In addition to that kind of testing, there was also brain imaging done, something called volumetric MRI, which is a fancy kind of MRI that's able to measure the size of the brain and see how much change there is over time, see if there's shrinkage of the brain in the areas that we know are most affected in Alzheimer's, see if the medicine changes that rate of shrinkage, and also looking at the amount of proteins like amyloid and tau in the brain in these subjects.
When a patient first comes to you with, let's say, suspected symptoms or mild symptoms, if a family member says, can you take a look at grandpa, will you automatically do a brain examination, or will you just start with this sort of baseline cognitive and memory test?
Well, I think the first thing is to talk to a patient, hear what they've got to say, what they see going on, if anything, and also very, very importantly, to talk to some observer, to talk to their spouse or their child or a friend, somebody from their church. It's so imperative when somebody comes in for a cognitive evaluation that they not come in alone. There are some folks who early in a process like Alzheimer's can talk a great game, but you find out when you talk to somebody else, oh no, they haven't driven in 3 years. Last time they tried to cook, we had to call the fire department. So you really need to have this independent information. That's the first step.
It's all subjective information, though, to some extent, isn't it? In other words, you're dealing with person A's reaction to the patient.
Well, it's not so much their reaction. It's their report of, yes, they're still able to cook pretty well. Well, no, if we don't help them with the shaving, they can't quite figure that out. They're able to dress themselves, but we have to pull the clothes out for them, or they're able to put their shirt on, but they can't figure out which side of the pants is which.
Yeah.
So these are not subjective. They're a report of what somebody is able to do. That's the first part. We usually look at some baseline laboratory information. We want to make sure that somebody doesn't have a liver problem or a kidney problem. They don't have an underactive thyroid or a vitamin B12 deficiency as the cause of the problem. And then unless there's some reason not to, we will almost always get some sort of a brain imaging study. MRI is preferred, but if somebody has a pacemaker or they have a cochlear implant or something like that that prevents an MRI, then we'll do a CAT scan. We want to get a look at the brain to see if there's something else going on. We want to look to see if there are early changes in the memory areas of the brain, some shrinkage of those areas. That is a tip-off that Alzheimer's is what we're dealing with, or find out if there's some other process going on.
The number to call here on this Medical Monday is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center joins us today. And let's go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania. Jim, you're on.
Hi, Jim.
Sugar is kind of a bad guy in medicine, but the brain uses glucose as its main source of nutrition. What effect, if any, do you think this might have on Alzheimer's?
Well, we know that there is an important relationship between glucose and Alzheimer's disease. People who have diabetes have about 3 times the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. We also know that although glucose is the main energy substrate, the main source of energy for the brain, that if your glucose is too high, that the brain efficiency drops very quickly. This is also where exercise comes in. We know that people who exercise regularly handle glucose better. And it's not just in the rest of the body, but also the brain's reaction to it. So glucose is an important thing. The brain certainly needs it, but it needs the right amount of it.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart is our guest today on Medical Monday. Wendy in Woodstock. Wendy.
Yeah, I have a question. Can you hear me?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to hang up, but I just want to question the connection between autoimmune disorders and Alzheimer's.
Okay, the connection between autoimmune disorders and Alzheimer's. Thank you, Wendy.
So autoimmune disorders are disorders where the immune system, which is basically the brain or the body's way of attacking outside invaders, misrecognize parts of the body as being outside invaders. Rheumatoid arthritis is a common autoimmune disorder. Type 1 diabetes is actually an autoimmune disorder where the body attacks the insulin-secreting cells in the pancreas. There are a number of autoimmune disorders that can affect the brain. There's something called autoimmune encephalitis. There's something called paraneoplastic encephalitis, which is kind of an off-target response to a cancer. At this point, most people do not believe that Alzheimer's is an autoimmune disease, although there is some role for immune reactivity in the Alzheimer's process. How much exactly remains a subject of contention?
You know, you mentioned at the beginning of the show that Dr. Alzheimer, and I didn't even know there was one, kind of set the stage and discovered this 110, 120 years ago. And we still don't know what it is.
Well, if you think about it, figuring out what's going on in any biologic system entails being able to study it. If you want to know what's going on in the muscle, you can take a piece of the muscle out and you can look at it under a microscope. Usually there's plenty of other muscle tissue there, and all of your biceps muscle is doing the same thing. It's all working to bend the elbow. You take a little bit of the lateral part of the biceps, the middle and the medial parts of the biceps are going to take over for it. But if you take out a chunk of brain, that's a chunk that no other part of the brain was really handling. And so it's, you know, I always tell patients the best way for us to figure this out would be to look at your brain under the microscope. It's really hard to duct tape it back together afterwards and have it be any good to you. So we have to settle for all these other things.
And there's only a certain amount of information you can get from looking at the brain of somebody who has deceased.
Right. I mean, that is the best information, but the goal certainly is to be able to assess people while they're living, while they're behaving as close to normal as possible, and try and figure out what's going on. That's why a thorough neurologic exam is important. A lot of my patients come in for memory loss. They don't understand why I'm taking their shoes and socks off. It's because I can't just pop the brain out and look at it under a microscope. So I have to test out all the different things that the brain does. And this is part of that.
Our number here on Medical Monday is 1-800-348-2551. We talk Alzheimer's today with Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center. And we go to Joan in Massachusetts. Joan, you're on.
Hi. I've read that oxybutynin has been associated with Alzheimer's. If one were to discontinue it after being on it for several years, would it still be associated with Alzheimer's?
Well, I think that's a really good question, and it's a common one that we deal with in the office. So oxybutynin is a bladder medicine. It is from a class of medicines called anticholinergics. It blocks the effect of acetylcholine, and that's very good for helping to control an overactive bladder. Some of the antihistamine medicines, some over-the-counter sleeping medicines, things that have Benadryl or diphenhydramine in them, are also anticholinergics. There is an association between these medications, though, and an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. I mentioned a medicine earlier, something called donepezil or Aricept, and this is a medicine that raises the amount of acetylcholine in the brain. More acetylcholine is good in the brain, but more acetylcholine may be not a good thing in the bladder. So for my patients who are on a medicine like oxybutynin, I want them to talk with their prescribing doc, whether that's a urologist or their family doctor, about whether there's another alternative which they could turn to instead. If somebody's not able to come off of it, then, you know, the bladder symptoms are symptoms that may just need to be treated. We don't know if there's a certain time frame of exposure, whether there's a certain age that is critical or whether it's a duration of treatment that's critical. You know, this is relatively recent information, and we don't really have the full knowledge of that yet.
And are they studying this? Somebody?
Another thing that we participate in at Albany Med is something called ADNI. This is the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative. And this is a very large observational trial. This is a trial that's been going on in various iterations since, I think, 2003. It collects information on people who are cognitively normal, people who have mild memory symptoms, people who have full-blown Alzheimer's disease, and it follows them over time. It keeps track of their exam findings, their brain imaging, their medications, and it creates a very large database that outside investigators can get access to. So if you have a question such as how many years exposure is going to put somebody at risk, or if we stopped it at this point, how much of a difference it would make, that's a question that can be answered. And so that and other similar databases can act as a repository to get that information.
Dr. David Hart is our guest today. Our number is 800-348-2551. A couple of quick emails here have come in. Actually, I think this is a tweet. This is from Patrick. What would you suggest in terms of advanced planning for those with a family history of Alzheimer's or major neurocognitive disorder to ensure that their end-of-life care wishes are honored?
It's a great question. I think first thing in terms of advanced planning in people who have a family history is for the family more than the patient, that being aware that there's a family history really is yet another stimulus to all of us to get out and be more physically active, that there is a strong negative correlation between exercise and Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
People who exercise more tend to be protected later in life. But if somebody is developing cognitive difficulties, I think the best first step is to make sure that they have a will, make sure that that's up to date. I think meeting with a good elder law attorney, and there are a number of practices in the Capital District and elsewhere, so that you can look at things like making sure that people have the right advance directives, their will, their directives for what to do in case of a catastrophic event. People should consider whether they want to be resuscitated or not, if they have a cardiac arrest or something along those lines. So there's a lot that goes into that, and meeting with a good elder law attorney is a great way of handling that.
This email came in from Mike, and Mike wants to know, can ultrasound be used in treatment?
That is an open question. So there have been some trials looking at whether doing something called transcranial ultrasound may be therapeutic. And the concept is that there's a structure called the blood-brain barrier, and
right,
it prevents too much from the periphery from getting into the central nervous system. And the idea is that with this therapeutic ultrasound, you may temporarily open the blood-brain barrier, and you may make it easier for some of the bad stuff to get out of the brain, for example, to allow amyloid to leach out of the brain and get into the rest of the body where it can be cleared. So there have been some preliminary studies which have shown some potential benefit to that. I think it's too early to say whether that will really pan out. Unfortunately, there have been many, many things which have looked great in early trials, and when they've been scaled up and really looked at thoroughly, they have not come through for us.
You have overseen numerous clinical trials. What is the one that looked most promising that ended up not panning out?
I think at this point that would be the Lilly solanezumab trial. This was a trial which was done a couple of years ago, another monoclonal antibody targeting amyloid. They looked at people with mild and moderate severity Alzheimer's disease. At the end of the trial, they found that it didn't meet its overall objective, but if they looked at just the patients with mild disease, there was quite a significant slowing of progression. It was about a 34% reduction in progression. And both because of the fact that the study was looking at mild and moderate patients, so it might not have been powered to see how effective it could really be, and because something called amyloid PET imaging was just coming into use in clinical trials at that point. And a lot of patients who were in the study did not have amyloid accumulation in the brain by PET scan, so probably wouldn't benefit from an amyloid-based therapy. When they then went to do a dedicated trial for people who had mild disease only and only patients who had amyloid in the brain by PET scan, it was thought that this was going to be a slam dunk. And unfortunately, it did not come anywhere close to the degree of benefit that the kind of redoctored or post hoc analysis trial had from a couple of years prior, and that was an enormous disappointment. It was a great medicine. It was very safe, but unfortunately, at least at the doses that were used, not effective.
But you said that it did, in fact, slow the progression by 34% in those with mild Alzheimer's. I mean, can't you redo the numbers as they did recently with this other drug?
So what they did was after getting that, so they looked at basically a pooled analysis from two trials, which was scientifically interesting but not considered statistically valid. And they said, okay, so we want statistical validity. We want to really know that this is the proof that this is going to be effective. So they did an entire separate trial just looking at patients with mild disease, just looking at those patients and just enriching the population for those people who had a positive amyloid PET. So we knew we were treating patients who had amyloid in the brain. And only people who were hopefully not too far along to be benefited from it. It unfortunately did not show much of a difference between treatment and placebo.
Dr. David Hart is our guest. It's Medical Monday, Alzheimer's Today. 1-800-348-2551 is our number. 1-800-348-2551. Paul in Greenville, Mass. Paul, you're on.
Hi there. I'm interested in having learned about the glymphatic system, which drains toxins from the brain and its relationship to deep wave sleep. I wonder if you could talk about that and also about the emerging potential for drugs that enhance your ability to get that deep wave sleep.
I think that's a couple of great questions there. There really are three kind of vascular pathways in the body. There's the arterial system that carries oxygenated blood away from the heart and the lungs to the body. There's the venous system that carries it back. And then there's something called the lymphatic system, which drains the extracellular fluid, goes through the lymph nodes that we're all aware of. Everybody's heard of lymph nodes. And it filters that fluid, and then it dumps it back into the bloodstream. It was thought until very recently that the brain did not have a lymphatic system, but it turns out that it actually does. So this was just discovered a couple of years ago, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, and that's called the glymphatic system. So that is a system for drainage of material out of the brain and into the lymphatic system. Paul was also mentioning that there is an association between deep wave sleep. So the deeper stages of sleep are when the brain is best at getting amyloid out. So we know that people who sleep better seem to have a lower risk. People who don't sleep well have a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's. And we think it's because amyloid is primarily cleared during sleep. Whether medicines that enhance deep wave sleep, whether medicines that force the brain into those deeper stages of sleep will be effective or not is a great question, but I don't think we have that answer at all at this point.
Paul, thank you for the call. The number is 800-348-2551. Dr. David Hart is our guest. You mentioned a lymphatic system for the brain more or less recently discovered. How did science miss it?
Have you ever looked at brain slices?
Well, not recently.
Looking at the brain, again, you know, it's not something that we get to do very often from living brain. So you're looking at post-mortem brain, where as soon as death occurs, the brain starts to deteriorate. One of the things I mentioned Alzheimer first describing the changes in the brain in 1905. One of the reasons that he was able to do that was that he and another neuroscientist, Franz Nissl, had come up with some new microscope stains, some new ways of staining brain tissue. When they did that, they found these accumulations that nobody had seen before. So they just were not evident until they looked at it in just the right way. And so I think that's part of what happened with the glymphatic system.
Our guest is Dr. David Hart. We'll take a quick break here. Medical Monday, the number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC Medical Monday. Dr. David Hart is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. And we have one email here, doctor, and then we'll jump back on the phones for the home stretch. This one is from Andrew. And Andrew says, my grandfather suffered from Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease for roughly the last decade until he passed earlier this year. He was unable to speak coherently for the duration of his sickness, but he was always able to sing songs quite well. He could recite most of the oldies he remembered verse for verse. Is there any scientific reason that people who suffer from these cognitive diseases are able to do such things?
Yeah, I think there's a great reason for that. And the reason is that different kinds of information are processed and stored differently in the brain. So I mentioned earlier that there are different kinds of memory. There is music memory, and your memory for song lyrics or for tunes is stored in a different area in the brain, a different set of neurons in the brain than your memory for what different words mean or your memory for what different smells signify. These are all different areas of memory, different domains of memory. And so some disorders will affect one much more than another.
Do we know? In other words, let me now lay my ignorance bare for you. But the plaque or whatever it is that gums up the works in these sections of the brain, what is physically different about this other section of the brain that, say, remembers memory very well? Is there an actual tangible physical difference between the neurons in section A and section B?
I guess the best answer is I'm really not sure. We do know that in Alzheimer's disease, the primary presentation is loss of short-term memory as the first symptom. It's not the only presentation. There are some patients who present with visuospatial difficulties, have some patients who their first symptom is, I had a patient who was telling me she was getting onto the thruway and there was a truck coming through the tolls next to her and she was so close to the truck that she had to stay over to the side. She ended up misjudging the distances because of this problem in visual processing. She ended up staying so far to the side that she drove down the off-ramp. And she didn't realize her mistake until she saw all these cars driving right towards her, flashing their lights.
Yeah.
Fortunately, nobody was hurt. So there are some folks who may have visuospatial difficulties as their presentation. There are some folks where it's not so much memory as the ability to come up with words. I had a patient many years ago who had a primary progressive aphasia. He was losing words. He couldn't find the words that he wanted. This fellow was a... He had a technical job. He was a supervisor in the construction business, and he was so good at what he did and had worked for his company for so long that when he became unable to supervise other people because he couldn't say, hey, all right, you go work on this part, you go work on that part, but he could still do his own work, they kept him on for an additional several years with the supervisor just double-checking him and making sure he was doing okay with it. And he did for a number of years. So different parts of the brain may be affected at different times. Most often it's memory that's affected first, but not always. I mentioned that there are two different proteins that build up in the brain. There's amyloid, which is the first sign, but the tau protein, which happens later in the process, where tau builds up seems to correlate very well with where people's symptoms are. And that's why I don't know if I came out and said this, but I think I hinted at the idea that when we get to having some tau treatments in the clinic, that may be much more effective in halting the disease process because it's going to be much more focused to where the problem really is occurring.
So then I can surmise that these proteins sort of, maybe not randomly, but they'll pick a section and they will build up in a section of the brain that does X, that controls X. Do we know why it's seemingly random and not a general increase across the entire brain?
There has to be a why. But no, I don't think anybody really knows that yet. And, you know, we know, as I said, going back to 1905, we know the changes that happen in the brain in Alzheimer's disease. We don't really know why that happens. There are, you know, a few, maybe 1% or so of patients who develop Alzheimer's disease have a single gene that has doomed them to develop it. This is almost entirely in people who have early onset Alzheimer's, onset before age 65, and usually well before age 65, people are developing symptoms in their 30s or in their 40s.
Yeah.
But other than those folks who have a clear genetic abnormality And we think we understand some of the ways that that interacts to produce Alzheimer's. But for the rest of us, we don't really know what it is that, that triggers the process, even though we kind of know what the process is once the dominoes start falling.
Let's go back to the phones. The phone lines are loaded here, and we have to get through as many as we can. Our number is 800-348-2551. Joanne has been waiting about 20 minutes. Joanne in Albany, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Yes, great. I can hear you.
Splendid.
So my question has to do with long-term versus short-term memory. And the brief version is I have a friend of almost 40 years whose short-term memory seems to be intact, but cannot remember many important things that we've done anywhere from 2 years ago to 35 years ago. Doesn't remember names of spouses, of close friends, things like that.
So I think there are two different things tied up in there. One is that our memory for names, names of people, proper nouns, does seem to normally fade with age. Most people, once they hit age 50, are familiar with that. And that's not necessarily a sign of a disease process going on. That's considered part of normal aging of the brain. Usually, in Alzheimer's disease, it is short-term memory that goes first and more long-term memory that goes later. Sometimes when I see a patient who says, I can't remember my kids' milestones, I can't remember, you know, when, you know, I got down on my knee and proposed or things like that. Sometimes that is not because of a memory disorder going on, but a different process. Sometimes there may be other issues, anxiety, there may be sleep deprivation, distraction for other reasons which get in the way of being able to pull out those memories.
So is this still a person, though, that should get a referral to a neurologist?
Well, I think if somebody is just remembering what Joe's wife's name is, or you know what the name of their dog was 10 years ago, no, I don't think I would worry about that at all. But if somebody's
This is extensive.
Right. So then I think that certainly should be assessed.
Okay. So might want to take a look. Joanne, thanks for the call. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Medical Monday today. Alzheimer's the topic. Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center is with us, and so is Daniel in Northampton. Daniel, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if you thought that any psychedelics might show any benefit for people with Alzheimer's or risk of developing.
If you mean psychedelics specifically, things like LSD and so forth, or if you're meaning psychoactive medications like cannabinoids, THC.
Well, for example, ayahuasca, ibogaine, psychedelic mushrooms, salvia divinorum, even the users report long-term memory recall, improved concentration, even, you know, mood lift. And I was wondering if you know anything about, you know, any connection there.
Well, I would say no, I really don't. But I know that some of the neuroactive compounds have their effect by mimicking the effect of different brain chemicals. And I'm very leery about doing anything that's playing around with the brain's communication chemical structure. I think that that's when people say they have better memories, it'd be an interesting thing to really measure whether they do or whether that's their perception that their memories are better or more vivid. You know, it's an area that has not been well studied, but it's something I would be very cautious about.
Daniel, thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Lisa in the Berkshires. Lisa, you're on.
Hi. I have two quick questions. One, is there any link with somebody who suffers from chemo brain with maybe developing or being more likely to develop Alzheimer's? And my second question is, when my grandmother was older, and I'm 46 now, when my grandmother was older, she had a lot of memory loss, and they never once said Alzheimer's. They said dementia. So could you explain the difference?
Sure.
Thank you.
Let me take the second question first, because it's one that I get a lot. what is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease?
Right.
And I think the easiest way to understand it is, what's the difference between colors and blue? Blue is a color. It's a very common color. Alzheimer's is a dementia. The formal name of it is Alzheimer's dementia. And so the dementias as a whole are a group of disorders that lead to an acquired loss of brain function. So somebody is functioning at a certain level all of their life and they start declining from there. That is a dementia. Alzheimer's will generally affect memory. Something called frontotemporal dementia will generally affect behaviors or language function. Parkinson's dementia may affect visuospatial functioning and cause hallucinations. There are different kinds of dementing processes. Alzheimer's accounts for 65%, more or less, of the dementia. So it's far and away the most common, but it is just one of the dementias. So that's the first question.
Okay.
The second,
what is chemo brain?
So chemo brain is changes in cognitive function, changes in memory that happen as a side effect of being exposed to chemotherapy. I'm not sure that there is one common pathway for that occurring across different kinds of medications. It's probably slightly different processes for different medications, but it basically is some damage occurring to the brain as a result of the chemotherapy, which is a byproduct a lot of us are willing to put up with because getting rid of the cancer is a thing of primary importance. Anything that damages the brain a little bit, though, is going to increase the risk of, or at least increase the ease that an underlying process like Alzheimer's will come out with. So somebody who's had a stroke is more likely. Somebody who's had a traumatic brain injury is more likely to manifest their Alzheimer's disease or do so at an earlier age.
Lisa, thanks for the call. It's Medical Monday on WAMC Vox Pop. Dr. David Hart is our guest today. And Lenore in Turner's Falls, you're on.
Hi. I joined you late. I hope I'm not duplicating a question. Do you have any more updates on correlation between, I think it was benzodiazepines and dementia, Xanax, and I can't remember the other, Ativan. Thank you.
Sure. So we have not talked about that, but the benzodiazepines are a common class of anxiety medications. Valium is diazepam, lorazepam is Ativan, Xanax is alprazolam. So these medicines all are considered minor sedatives, as opposed to medicines like Haldol and Thorazine, which are major tranquilizers. So there are medicines that depress brain function. In somebody who's overly keyed up and anxious all the time, that may be helpful. But if you're turning down brain activity a little bit, in the long term, that may not be healthy. And so in my patients, especially in older patients, if I have somebody in their late 60s or beyond who's taking that kind of medicine, I certainly want them to continue taking it if they need it, but I also want them to take the lowest dose that they need so there's the least possible interference from that.
Thank you for the call. It seems that so many people in this society today, including those in high school and college and whatever, are being prescribed these drugs. Does it concern you that 30, 40 years down the road, we will have a real issue on our hands?
Well, I think that that we've got a real issue coming one way or the other as we have the aging of the baby boom. And I was looking a couple of days ago and preparing for a presentation at data from the Alzheimer's Association and the number of Americans by 2050 that will have Alzheimer's disease is extraordinary. And unfortunately, the number of neurologists is not growing nearly as fast.
Hmm.
But yeah, as I said before, I think anything that alters brain chemistry has to make you, you know, at least a little bit concerned about what the long-term consequences are going to be. In every medical treatment situation, though, you look at risks versus benefits.
Right.
So if you look at somebody who's not functioning well, who's miserable, who has no quality of life, and you have something that may be able to affect that dramatically, then their risk for something four decades down the road is not as great a consideration. I mean, is it really a benefit to lower that risk 40 years from now, but have them spend the intervening four decades miserable and non-functional as a result of this disorder that could be treated? I think the answer is no.
Dr. David Hart is our guest, and Michael in Latham is next. Michael.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking our questions. You spoke about when I came in on this conversation, it was about Aricept. And I have a question about the Aricept. How effective is it? And it's my understanding there's only like a handful of drugs currently out there for use.
Well, that's right. There are
not being one of them.
Correct. There are three medicines that are classed as cholinesterase inhibitors. So they slow the breakdown of acetylcholine, which is a chemical the brain uses for memory and attention. Donepezil or Aricept is one. Ribostigmine or Exelon is another. And galantamine, which at one point was called Razadine and at another Reminyl, is the third. So these medicines are first-line therapy for symptomatic memory loss. For one of the common ways we assess people is with a scale called the Mini Mental State Exam. It's a 30-point scale. On average, somebody with mild disease, mild Alzheimer's disease, will lose about 3 points a year on the Mini Mental State. On average, somebody who takes a medicine like Aricept will see about a 3-point bump from that medicine. It doesn't fix the underlying problem. It doesn't slow progression. But it, for some people, it may turn the clock back a year, which is a significant benefit. There's a fourth medicine, memantine or Namenda, which works on a different system, has a similar kind of benefit. Using that with one of the three cholinesterase inhibitors is often done because the two of them working on different pathways at the same time can have an additive benefit.
Thanks for the call, Michael. And now to Patricia in Walden. Patricia, you have about a minute or so.
I had a question about my sister's been in a nursing home for a couple of years, and just the past couple of months, her memory has become really bad, so that every time I bring her back again, she's terrified. She doesn't know where she is. And I was just wondering, is there any way to deal with that that would make it easier for her? That was my question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the first thing is if somebody has had a more acute decline, you would want to make sure that there's not a new medicine or an underlying infection that's causing it. But trying to, if you're talking about bringing her home for a visit or something like that, trying to make sure that there are things around from well in her past that can help reorient her and reassure her that she's in a familiar place, she's at home, that may be helpful. Playing music from her younger years, having photos around, things like that may be clues that, you know, try to get to the different pathways, different areas of memory that we're talking about, to try and stimulate as many different areas at once as possible to make her feel more comfortable.
All right, doctor, in the remaining 35 seconds we have, is there a cure down the road, or is that a pipe dream?
I think amazing things are coming. I hope they're coming soon. I think the biggest things that we all can do for ourselves and for our families is to exercise more, to eat right, something resembling the Mediterranean diet or the MIND diet, try and get enough sleep, and enjoy our loved ones while they're around. Let our kids know that we love them.
That's great advice. Thank you for being here. Support comes from Sue's Reflexology, Hadley, Massachusetts, specializing in the art of relieving stress and muscular tension through reflexology. When the mind and body are relaxed, healing can take place. Suesreflexology.com. Thanks again to Dr. David Hart of Albany Medical Center for joining us today. Thank you. Some very good questions today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, who only got annoyed at the very end of the program, so we did very well. Thank you, Zach. Joe Makowitz answered the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Gordon Fricke returns with his car stethoscope, and we'll do an automotive show. Stand by now for the Media Project.